What a charming little song from Stan Ransom there, My Long Island Home, from the album of that title. Now, Stan Ransom, I could take up this whole time set aside for the interview with just reading his resume of all the things that he's done, including being an Army veteran, a lumberjack, a musicologist, a musician, a storyteller, and a librarian. He was the director of the Huntington Public Library for about 15 years, and then Stan plays, I'm going to list them here, the guitar, the hammer, dulcimer, mandolin, banjo, the kora, the charango, the auto harp, and the bowed psaltery, and that's just, really, that is just a couple. Please welcome the man that the Plattsburgh Chamber of Commerce named 1998 Irishman of the Year, the one and only Connecticut peddler, Stan Ransom. Hey, Stan, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be on.
glad to have you on. Now, My Long Island Home, the song that we just played, did you write that?
No. I only wrote one song on those two CDs. That was I Love Long Island.
Oh, okay. So My Long Island Home was a traditional number or fairly recent?
My Long Island Home... There were several, My Own Long Island, My Long Island Home, I think, written by,
I'm just curious how far they go back. Are they like 100 years?
It was probably written in 1928. I think by a fellow named Ed Greenwood, with music by Hugh Knox. There were a number of songs written in the 20s that extolled the virtues of Long Island. Long Island at that time was becoming somewhat interesting to the people who lived in New York City. So a lot of people in the 20s decided to move out to Long Island. It was all farmland. There was plenty of land available. It was cheap. And then they had the Long Island Railroad, so they could take that, or if they had a car, they could come right into town.
Also, those were the years of F. Scott Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby. So that kind of put Long Island on the map in its way as well.
On the Gold Coast, up near Oyster Bay.
What got you investigating the songs of Long Island? And then, when you realized you were really interested in it, how did you go exploring and finding the songs and the poems of that, well, not just of that era, but going backwards and forwards?
That was a fun thing to do. Of course, I was a librarian. First, I worked at New York Public Library for about 5 years and then got a little restless, and my wife and I decided we would come to the more rural areas of Long Island. So applied for a job as at the Huntington Public Library and was assistant director for 2 years and then director in 1958. Yeah. All this time, I'd been interested in folk music. I'd been playing music since like the fifth grade in school. And so I was always looking for new songs. In Long Island, I asked about songs on Long Island. They said, no, there aren't any. There's no traditional music on Long Island. It's all, Broadway stuff and popular things. And I didn't believe them. So I started asking around and found one or two. And then I really started in depth. And this was early in the 1960s. I was part of the folk music revival where people would come out from New York City and we started to play some of the old songs. I had a lot of friends who played different instruments, banjos and guitars and fiddles. Mm-hmm. And we looked into some of those. But mostly what we were singing at that time was the popular things, the Kingston Trio type, and that were popularized on the radio. But I wanted to find out more deeply what was going on in Long Island. So I started with libraries, being a librarian, and I looked in all the old local history collections, every single one that I could find, the Smithtown, East Hampton had a good collection, the Pennypacker collection. I went into New York City to the New York Historical Society, the Long Island Historical Society, and I began to pick up quite a few songs, which I could copy down. They were all in the public domain. And then I started reading a lot of the diaries of people who'd lived in Long Island, or sto- stories about Long Island, and in there, once in a while, you'd find a song or a mention of a song like Wainscot Dumpling.
You can't mention a song with a name like that without my actually playing it. Here is Stan Ransom. It's a very short song doing Wainscot Dumpling. And that's the song. That's Wainscot Dumpling. Two verses, and you're out.
That's a children's song of 1832.
1832, wow.
Yep. I found that in Edwards' book called Whale Off, published in 1956. And there it was. And in some cases, a lot of these were poetry, and I put music to it. I composed a tune for that one. Another one that a little later on that I found out was very interesting was one called Where Are the Stones? And that was...
I think they're touring next year, aren't they? No, I'm kidding. Okay.
This was a poem by Samuel Young. So, Where are the stones that mark the bones of those who die in Oyster Bay? And, of course, the refrain is, there are no stones to mark the bones of those who die in Oyster Bay on clams and such nutritious foods they live till Resurrection Day. So this was a 19th century tribute to the long-lived residents of Oyster Bay.
Well, actually, that's a pretty short song, too. Do you mind if we give one a spin?
Oh, sure.
This is also from Stan Ransom's CD, I Love Long Island. And did you compose the music to this one, or did this come with the music?
The tune, I composed the tune to this one.
Where Are the Stones? More from Stan Ransom, Where Are the Stones? A song that, again, he found, and is that also from the early and mid-1800s?
That was from a book by Overton called The Long Island Story. Wow. I found that and put my tune to it.
I'm kind of curious, what is the earliest song that you came across when you started investigating the music and the history of Long Island life?
Well, one of the things I found was a book called The Gentleman's Miscellany, published in New York in 1814. And it had a lot of tunes in it that were popular in Long Island. It was a tune book. There were a number of other songs that I came across in tunes that seemed to be earlier but not identified as to dates. I talked with a lot of people, folk singers and fiddlers and so on in Long Island, and they would give me names of tunes and things like that, like Rustic Reel and others. Eric Martin from Bethpage Restoration gave me a number of tips on songs and tunes, so I used those. I don't have a date for the earliest ones, but there were such things as Tom Bowling. Tom Bowling was a sailor who had died. He fell from the mast and died, and this was a popular song, but it was written or composed by Charles Dibdin before 1814. It was sung by a midshipman in 1780 while it was anchored off Gardner's Island in a book called Early Memories of Gardner's Island. So 1780 would be one of the ones.
Well, that's pretty. My brain just doesn't really fathom history the way it ought to. One of the great things when in like high school history classes and social studies was when a professor would connect things so that this was happening here in the world and this was happening there and this was happening over there, and they're all kind of connected because of shipping and because of things that were going on. And I loved when he did that, but I never remember it. I just remember pieces of history. So it still intrigues me of, like, at what point did Long Island become a place for fisher people as opposed to, I don't know, Indians or first settlers or pilgrims or Puritans, and then at what point did the shipping life develop and the clamming and all that?
Probably in the 1660s, because Connecticut claimed eastern Long Island in 1665 and 6, and it didn't last too long. But during that time, there were a lot of activity of people going back and forth from Connecticut to the end of Long Island. They didn't go around through New York City. They just went across on the ships. boats. People just didn't think anything about it. They would just sail across to Stamford or other places, Lunar London, and go to church. That's what the Lloyds did from Lloyd Neck, which is just above Huntington, back when they were in charge of Queen's Village, as their manor was called.
Huh. Now, you still make your home. Are you on the island, or are you up in the Adirondacks now?
Oh, I'm up in the Adirondacks in Plattsburgh. After I was about 17 years on Long Island, I got a chance to direct a three-county library system, Clinton, Essex, and Franklin County Library System, in 1974. So my family and I came up here then and enjoyed the Adirondacks. But, you know, there's a great connection, Dave, between Long Island and North Country of New York State, which I don't think people really appreciate. Plattsburgh was settled in 1785 by a fellow named Zephaniah Platt and Melanchthon Smith. They were from Smithtown, Long Island.
Oh.
And having a little money and being canny people, they bought up all the scrip for land that was given to Revolutionary War soldiers. The government couldn't pay the soldiers, so they said, well, here's 100 acres of land. This paper will give you this land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most people either didn't want to move from where they were, and they didn't have any real desire to go wherever the land was. So speculators like Zephaniah Platt would come along and say, hey, I'll give you a penny on a dollar for your land. And boy, that was good money. So they bought up all the kinds of land from up in the North Country. So Zephaniah Platt, Melanchthon Smith, and many other people came north and founded Plattsburgh, 20 miles from the Canadian border, and all the other areas around here. So there's so much Long Island activity around here that even when I was talking with Mrs. Geist, who at that time was the curator of the John Howard Payne House, the long, home sweet home house in East Hampton, she said, yeah, my grandfather was a man named Averill, who was one of the hallowed names up here. He was a very important person, and he was in Plattsburgh, and he did maps of Clinton County and so on. There's still quite a connection to the point where when I came up here, our college here was full of college students from Long Island. A lot of them said, well, the highest point on Long Island is Jane's Hill. It's 632 feet high, and it doesn't give much skiing experience. So we want to go to the Adirondacks, so they come to Plattsburgh State, and then they can have access to all the Adirondacks has to offer. So there's a very strong connection between Long Island and the North Country, surprisingly.
We're talking with Plattsburgh citizen and also Long Island former, and not, well, citizen, resident, I should say, American citizen, certainly, and a real musicologist and researcher into the musical section of American history. But I want to ask Stan Ransom some more stuff about the other things that he's done in his life, which is, I mean, you were in the military just after World War II, and you were stationed in Japan.
That's right. For about a year and a half, I was in the Army of Occupation in Japan and Beppu in the southern part in Kyushu. Traveled all over Japan with Army outfits. It was an eye-opener for a little farm boy from Connecticut, so
I
learned
like
a lot.
Well, I mean, what was it like being in Japan in post-war? I mean, obviously not all of Japan was blown to smithereens like Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I mean, I assume most of the rest of it was kind of okay and built up. But what was it like for a farm boy in his uniform spending a year and a half in Japan?
Well, it was a very interesting and eye-opening experience. The little children were all dressed in beautifully bright clothes. The Japanese didn't have much food at that time, so we weren't permitted to use their food, but we were able to talk with them. I gave English lessons at the Beppu Self Cultural Association downtown. We could take advantage of trips to go see the giant Buddhas and religious shrines and places, the beautiful gardens, the Zen gardens, all of the other things that were going on. So we had enough spare time so we could get around and see some of Japan. I was 2 days, I toured Nagasaki about a year after the bomb had gone off. So was just awed by the terrible destruction that the nuclear bomb made.
But, it was atomic. if it was nuclear, yeah. None of us would be
well,
here, I think.
Well, sorry, the atomic bomb that went off. But anyway, it's a beautiful country. And
how were the people? How were the people to you as an American serviceman, a victorious American serviceman?
The war was over, and they were very friendly. They wanted to know more about America. They wanted to know English. They wanted to try and get to know the people who were there. And for the most part, our army was helpful to the Japanese people, trying to enable them to have jobs and to get food and just to live. So they appreciated our being there. The war being over, we didn't have resentment on the most of the people that we saw. In fact, all of the people that I met, they were mostly anxious to become what sounded like they wanted to become Americanized, or at least to find out enough about us so that they could take benefit from anything that we had to offer. So it was a very good experience. I got to know a little Japanese language. I just think it's a beautiful country, certainly worth visiting.
Now, were you a lumberjack before or after you were in the service and in Japan?
It was, well, both. From 1943 to 1950, I was a lumberjack and forest guard for the Connecticut Park and Forest Commission. So we'd go out and chop trees. We learned to be lumberjacks and learned to use the crosscut saw, the axes and splitters and everything else. And also I was in charge of a fire crew because there were a lot of forest fires. So it was kind of nice being called up out of an English class in high school because there was a forest fire, and I'd race down to get my truck and my crew with 1,000 gallons of water, and we would try and combat these forest fires, which had popped up, and sometimes all night long, trying to spray them and chop out the fire. So it was very rewarding, and helping to grow trees and distribute them to local farmers.
Oh.
I almost became a forest ranger, but then I thought, no, I'd rather do something with people and books. So became a librarian.
No, but that kind of threw me for a minute, because you would figure a lumberjack is someone who is just simply cutting down trees and making paper and buildings and stuff like that, not the idea of you're also planting and redistributing and kind of parks and recreational aspects of it, too. You know?
But it made me appreciate that one of the songs I found a couple of songs that hadn't been recorded, and one of the things I'm most pleased at is to find old songs that haven't been known or recorded and make sure I preserve them by making a CD that includes them and so on. One was called The Song of the Saranac River Drivers. Saranac River goes through Plattsburgh and out up into the woods, and found that song.
Do I have that one? Let me see. Is that on the CD that you gave me? Let's see. What was the song again? Sorry?
The song is called Song of the Saranac River Drivers.
I apparently do not. Sorry. No, I can't play that one for you.
It's in the Adirondack Sampler CD number 9.
Okay. Well, I don't have that. I've only got the two Stan Ransom CDs, which, by the way, I might as well tell everybody, if you're interested in hearing some of these lost and found songs, some of them with the authentic original music and some with music by Stan Ransom to kind of approximate the feel of what these songs would have sounded like, or maybe they were just poems and now they're put to music that's appropriate to them, you can get his CDs, including I Love Long Island and My Long Island Home, Stan, RANSOM.com. There's also the Connecticut Peddler.com. I know that's a different website of yours, but it's also you. What actually remind me, what is the Connecticut Peddler? What does that stand for?
The Connecticut Peddler I adopted as my stage name in 1951 because the Connecticut Peddler was known for going from Connecticut with all kinds of seeds, pins, needles, clocks, and traveling, first walking, then by cart, then by wagon, all over the North Country and the New England states, peddling his wares. So everywhere he went, he distributed things that came from Connecticut, which was more industrialized and had more factories than other areas. So it became a very famous figure for people to see going through the woods, through the farmlands, and they always welcomed this as they did other peddlers because they brought some new things, news as well as the clocks and seeds and things which they would like needles and pins and so on, which were hard to come by. They had no stores in the earlier days. I have a theme song called The Connecticut Peddler, but I don't think I've recorded it. It's a song that was actually written in 1851. So The Connecticut Peddler has been around for quite a long while. People say, well, why aren't you in Connecticut? I say, well, the peddler never stayed there. As I did, he peddled his stuff all over. I peddled songs and tunes, of course.
Absolutely. And also, the one thing that I haven't been able to mention yet is the fact of your having facility on quite a number of instruments. How did that all start? I mean, it's one thing to play the guitar, and maybe one thing to play a mandolin or an auto harp. But how did you start getting into and discovering and playing some instruments I've never heard of?
Well, little by little, I've played guitar and mandolin since I was about 15 or 20. Then the auto harp I've always known about. It was in our family. We're a musical family in Connecticut. I have a brother and three sisters, my mother and father. They were all musical, played instruments, and we always sang. At least once a week, we were always singing together with the choir in church and so on. So anyway, we just liked the idea of being able to play different instruments. So as they came along, I would try them out and play them. The hammer dulcimer I saw first in 1980. A friend of mine built one. So I immediately had to have one and got it and started taking lessons from whoever I could find. Now, I've been playing the hammer dulcimer for quite some years now, since 1980, and have about five of them now. And I really enjoy playing it. Some people call it a logger's piano. It was taken into the North Woods and played by loggers in the early days, a portable instrument. It's sort of like an upright piano with the front taken off. There you have the strings, and when you press a key, a hammer. A padded hammer comes out and hits the piano strings.
Hmm.
And so the hammer dulcimer is just the shortcut of it. It's a small portable soundboard with a lot of strings. My present one has 92 strings. They're in pairs, so there's 46 pairs of strings, a good bass and a treble. So I like to play that, and I play it quite a bit.
Stan, could you give us a sample of a song that's on one of the CDs that we have where people can hear the sound of a hammer dulcimer and you playing it.
I love Long Island. You'll find one of the Long Island ones. Let's see. Both Long Island ones have it on there. The one called My Long Island Home, the third cut is Carolyn's Concerto. Turlough O'Carolyn was a Irish harper, lived from 1670 to 1738, and he did about 200 tunes, and most hammer dulcimer players like to play his tunes. So there's two of them called Carolyn's Concerto and George Brabazon on there. Also, any of the others on there, like Shep Jones and Rustic Reel, those are all hammer dulcimer tunes, too.
Okay, well, let's share them, then. Here's Stan Ransom playing, and I believe this is just instrumental. There's no vocal on this.
Yeah.
So we'll hear a bit of Carolyn's Concerto from Stan Ransom's CD, My Long Island Home, and listen to the kind of nice, you almost feel like you're in a gift shop somewhere in New England when you hear this sound of the hammer dulcimer. from Stan Ransom on the Hammered Dulcimer. Stan Ransom is with us in the neighborhood talking about music and musical instruments, of which he knows many. And he was just telling me off mic that on his CDs, when there are more than one instrument going, he's actually playing all of them and doing the overdubs. Did you go into a recording studio and do these?
Yes, for most of them I went across the water, the pond here, Lake Champlain, to Charlotte, Vermont, where Charles Eller has his studio. And he and Lane Gibson, the engineer, fixed me up, and so I did most of my recordings there, except for the latest ones. Then they would make sure that everything was precisely correct in registration and so on, so that everything merged correctly.
Well, yeah, I would imagine, you know, the overdubbing. I'm reading a book about the Beatles as we speak, and just it's telling the kinds of stuff that George Martin was doing in the studio on a 4-track and an 8-track machine that people later are trying to recreate digitally. And it was amazing what he was doing in coordinating everything that the Beatles were doing musically, syncing it all up together. Rather fascinating stuff.
Yes.
But you mentioned, so you also play the mandolin, and which is actually the hardest instrument that you play? What was the hardest to learn and to master?
I haven't mastered the fiddle. I've had 4 days of lessons on it, and I decided I would leave the fiddle for those people who could spend more time on it. So I work on other stringed instruments. The two that you mentioned earlier, the charanga, which is a South African small guitar, 8-stringed, looks like a ukulele in size, but it has 8 strings, and it's often played in Argentina and the South American ones. I use that to accompany my storytelling of South American songs like Oh, Fox and Mole Go to the Moon, just picture book types of things. But it gives a flavor for that particular country. Another one I play is the kora, which is a kind of a harp-like instrument from Ghana. You can find them. The calabash is the bottom, and they have 2 horns sticking up with strings on them. When you play them with your fingers, they're fixed strings, so you just get 6 strings that you just plink in any particular way you want to. But they're also good for telling stories like the Colossal Pumpkin and other stories for children.
Cool. You still perform public? I mean, how are you 82 or 83 at this point?
I'm 83 now, and I'm director of the Plattsburgh Public Library, and that takes occupies me for about 50 hours a week.
Good
of course,
Lord.
I get paid for 37, but no, I go where the need is, and the need is always for more hours than I am paid for. Plus, I volunteer at the hospital library for my wife, who is the hospital librarian. I don't have as much time as I used to. I was retired for 16 years after I was a system director, and it's that period of time when I did the most music and my CDs. I just do it maybe occasionally, maybe once a month. I go to a school and do a program on the War of 1812 or revolutionary songs or some other kinds of things like that. I'm still working on another CD on revolutionary music of New York State, including a couple from Long Island and the North Country and the city and other areas, because there hasn't been one, in my estimation, that has done justice to the music of the American Revolution in New York State.
Huh. It just amazes me of how active you are. And this idea that your work week, your day job, is taking up 50 hours a week, and that's taking away from all the music and the performing and the CDs you want to make.
Right, so, yeah.
It sounds like you're in good shape. Are you? Are you in physically?
Oh, yes. I watch my weight. I've lost a lot of weight, and I exercise couple times a day. The YMCA is right across the street from the library, so I go there and exercise. My wife and I go walking at night, and we make sure we stay healthy. You know, I don't eat, unfortunately. I don't eat bagels and cream cheese. I miss.
Yeah.
But I'm eating more fruits and vegetables and enjoying it. But it's just wonderful to be able to play music, to talk about music, and to be involved in the musical scene. When I started, well, mm-hmm. I was part of the folk music revival in Long Island. I didn't do it myself. I had there was 10 or 15 other people in my group anyway. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know Jerry Silverman from New York City, who has done an awful lot of books on music. But he used to come out and play with us in the 60s during the civil rights era, where we were playing all of the songs, mm-hmm.
The Old Gray Goose? No,
Green Grass is Growing Over Me, Terrytown songs. Anyway, we would do civil rights songs, and the first song I wrote was called Murder of Edwin Moore, I think his name was. He was a postman in 1964 and was murdered because he was trying to stand up for civil rights.
Was he white? He was white man then.
Yes, and so he was shot and dumped in a ditch. And so that was the first song I wrote, and I never did anything with it. It's somewhere around. But then I started thinking, you know, I can write songs about topical things, things that have happened. And that's pretty much what I've done both in Long Island was traditional music,
right.
But upstate New York, I've done an awful lot of collecting of music and the Adirondacks, Lake Champlain song, the Battle of Plattsburgh CD, and others that are useful in telling people the history of New York State and parts of it, and teaching people songs that they might otherwise forget.
That's cool. Can I ask, as part of the 60s thing, were you influenced by Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Bob Dylan? So I don't know if that was totally separate from sort of the more traditionalist stuff, even though you were writing topical songs. I didn't know if you were influenced by what was going on more commercially in folk music, were you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, we all played the commercial songs.
You mentioned
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Example.
Yeah, and the Kingston Trio, and all of the Bob Dylan, the songwriters who were doing those things then. And we'd branch off and pick up local songs and sing those also. In fact, anything anybody wanted to bring out, we would try and work on and play. So we were pretty eclectic as far as our music tastes go, as long as it was interesting, topical, civil rights or history, funny songs. One of our group, Alan Lance, a school librarian from Greenlawn, was fond of doing the Unreconstructed Rebel. You may or may not know that song about I'm a good old rebel, and that's just what I am, and about this country, I do not give a damn, or something. It's an unreconstructed Southerner.
Okay.
However, he was himself no believer in that, but it was just a funny song.
Oh, sure, yeah.
We were doing all kinds of different kinds of songs, and I would talk with the folk musicians who came. Frank Warner was one of them. And he gave me a lot of tips on sea songs that he had heard about that were from Long Island, which I then tracked down, found, and learned, and then recorded. Just wanted to make sure I was as complete as possible in all of the songs and tunes I could find for Long Island. I have about 30 that I'd found that were traditional. As I say in my recordings, the only one that's not traditional is the song I wrote called I Love Long Island. In that, I tried to put in things that it interested me. For instance, Walt Whitman's birthplace was just south of Huntington, and I became a trustee of the Walt Whitman Birthplace Association and was very interested in Walt Whitman's poetry. And also, I had heard about a poet slave in Lloyd Neck, just north of Huntington.
Yes.
Not much was known about him, and like you seize an opportunity when you see it. So I started really looking into Jupiter Hammond and found his poetry in the Smithtown Library, the New York Historical Society. I went to Connecticut, hunted in the Connecticut Historical Society, and when I start going, I go as deep as I can. Uh-huh. And I came back with a whole lot of information about Jupiter Hammond, a slave poet born in 1711, died around 1800, and he was the first black poet to publish his own poetry on Christmas Day in 1760, about 10 years before Phyllis Wheatley of Boston. In fact, he even wrote a poem in honor of Miss Phyllis Wheatley. I wrote this book about the complete writings of Jupiter Hammond. At that time, when it came out, it was published in 1970, mm-hmm. came out as America's First Negro Poet, Jupiter Hammond of Long Island. And I'd asked all the black leaders, what do you like to be called, black, Negro? They said, oh, not black. Said, it's the Black Panthers. We don't like that term. So he said, use Negro. So that's why it came out as America's First Negro Poet.
And then 4 years later, he wished everything, he had not chosen that title.
Everything changed. It was too late. So it went into a second edition. It's now out of print. But on the basis of that, I decided we needed to have more emphasis on information on celebrating black contributions to America. And so I created a day called Black Poetry Day nationally, and that first was celebrated in Huntington in 1970. Had June Jordan come and some Amagansett and did her poetry. And it's been going ever since, and it leapfrogged up here to Plattsburgh, and our college, Plattsburgh State, every year has a Black Poetry Day celebration, and it's been going here since 1984. So anyway, Black Poetry Day was very important to me, and I also did some things like singing as the Connecticut Peddler for the opening of our Freedom Center in Huntington when that first started. It was a Freedom Center was an agency, a center that was to help blacks and children, particularly in things like education, reading, jobs, and everything else. I'm not sure if it's still going, but anyway, we all participated in trying to promote this opportunity for blacks that hadn't been available before to them. So anyway, I've been interested in black poetry, and I work on that every year with the college. So a little bit of this and a little bit of that keeps you busy.
Lord knows, I feel the same way, and if you looked at the schedule of my life, you would see that's exactly what I do. I hope it keeps me as fine condition and as the age that you're at. You know, if I make it to 83, I want to be as busy and in as tip-top condition as Stan Ransom is. He's been our guest in the neighborhood here on Dave's Gone By. If, as I said, if you want to pick up his CDs or learn more about the black poet Jupiter Hammond, your book is out of print, though. It's not like you don't have copies available.
Yeah, I can get it in out-of-print areas, but there's a lot of information about him, and I'm always pleased to be able to share any information that people are interested in.
Well, the best place to go is stanransom.com, R-A-N-S-O-M, stanransom.com, to get some of his music or to learn about his work or to find out about the songs and the poems that he has been archiving and collecting for so many decades, and hey, hopefully for another couple of decades to go. I think wishing you luck certainly also on your library work. It must be wild, like knowing what a library was when you first started working at them in the 1950s to what a library is today.
What a change.
I guess you don't get whiplash or shock because you've been through it steadily, as opposed to Rip Van Winkling it, where you go to sleep in 1962 and you wake up. But are you keeping pace with, I guess you have to, with all the modern technology?
Oh, yes, you have to. I'm on Facebook. I have an account on Twitter, but I don't have time to do a lot of the social networking, just Facebook. Also, of course, we're all computerized. No more card catalogs. Ah. Out they go. No more cards. So we're all online and working to, and in fact, we have a new service to help people with computer literacy. We have public access computers like most libraries do nowadays, mm-hmm. thanks to Bill and Melinda Gates and their foundation. And so we teach people how to use computers if they don't know, and we teach them how to look for jobs and get ready for employment, interviews, cover letters, job applications, resumes. So our library is very active in that area, as well as many other libraries, I'm sure, are doing.
Stan Ransom, I guess the word for you would be active. Active with poetry and music and books and you know, making your contribution to Long Island and New York and America, really, historically and currently. So I can't think of a better thing to be doing, and I just hope you keep on doing it. Thank you for being with us in the neighborhood this morning. We will close our chat with Stan Ransom with I Love Long Island. Is that the song that mentions Jupiter Hammond also?
The only one that mentions the black poet is I Love Long Island.
Right, that's the one that we're going to play to end the segment. And so,
also, if anyone wants to get in touch with me for questions, my email is sransom, S-R-A-N-S-O-M, @ Northnet, NORTHNET.org.
sransom @ Northnet.org. Well,
right.
Thank you, Stan, for getting in touch with us today. It's been really, really delightful chatting with you, and just keep doing what you're doing.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Dave.
Have a great one.
You too.